In the last lecture, the government of Edward VI attempted to wean England from Henrician Catholicism and administer its first full dose of Protestantism. Just about the time that that process began to pick up speed, it was halted by Edward's untimely death. Now Mary, the forgotten Tudor for much of her life, would get her turn. A loyal daughter of the Church, she would seek to undo nearly every one of Edward's initiatives. This lecture will cover the entire reign, first assessing Mary's character, her controversial marriage to Philip II of Spain, and the resultant Wyatt's Rebellion. It then addresses Mary's attempt to restore papal supremacy and the Roman Catholic Church in England via means of parliamentary legislation, the persecution by burning at the stake of Protestants who would not recant. That attempt would fail, mainly because her reign was too short and she failed to produce an heir. The lecture concludes with Mary's failed war with France and the loss of Calais and her grudging acknowledgement of Elizabeth I as her heir. As should be obvious, the theme of this lecture will be failure. The English people had rallied to Mary because she was the daughter of Henry VIII, thus a Tudor and the rightful heir. They did not do so because she was a woman. They did not do so because she was half Spanish or because she was Catholic. It was the great tragedy of Mary's reign that she failed to draw the obvious lesson from this. Her Tudor heritage was an advantage, to be exploited to the full, while her gender and her Spanish background were, in the eyes of her subjects, neutral factors at best, to be minimized and obscured if she was going to keep them happy. As for Catholicism, it divided her people. Either you loved it, or you hated it, or you were indifferent. Unfortunately, she would choose to subordinate her strong personality to the demands of her religion and her Spanish heritage, and to contemporary expectations of her gender. The result would be the only Tudor reign that could be called a failure, tragic, even pathetic. And yet, the new queen had many positive attributes which should have made for a successful reign. Like all Tudors, Mary was intelligent, courageous, dignified, and resilient. Like all Tudors, she'd had the benefit of a Renaissance education and was able to speak or read Spanish, French, Greek, and Latin, including Erasmus's Paraphrases and More's Utopia, which originally appeared in Latin. Nor was she entirely serious. She also danced and played the lute. Unlike her father, she had a sense of mercy. She spared, for now, Lady Jane Grey and Guildford Dudley, though she did lodge them safely in the Tower. And yet, one can sense in the following highly qualified description by the Venetian ambassador that Mary's hard life, remember that she'd been rejected by her father, as had her mother been, that Mary's hard life had left its mark. She is of low rather than middling stature, but although short, she has not personal defects in her limbs, nor is any part of her body deformed. Well, that's good to know. She is of spare and delicate frame, quite unlike her father, who was tall and stout, nor does she resemble her mother, who, if not tall, was nevertheless bulky. Note that even in her physical appearance, both of her parents disown her. She doesn't look like either one of them. When younger, she was considered not merely tolerably handsome, but of beauty exceeding mediocrity. At present, with the exception of some wrinkles, caused more by anxieties than by age, which makes her appear some years older, her aspect for the rest is very grave. Her eyes are so piercing that they inspire not only respect but fear in those in whom she fixes them. In short, she is a seemly woman, never to be loathed for ugliness, even at her present age, without considering her degree of queen. She was 37 years old. Finally, he noted in Mary, quote, a very deep melancholy, so that the remedy of tears and weeping, to which from childhood she has been accustomed and still often used by her, is not sufficient. Perhaps in her heart of hearts she knew something. The new queen, who had borne such anxieties and shed such tears, was in fact naive in politics and inexperienced in government. Her fine education had concentrated on moral instruction, not on the training necessary to be queen. Her father had rejected her until late in his reign. Even then, he still kept her from the corridors of power. Mary was never groomed to succeed. Lacking experience, she relied on her conscience and her faith. Mary's reign is full of ironies, and one of them is that Mary's virtues would turn out to be vices. That is to say, I mean, I'm sure we can agree that in general, a politician who relies on conscience and perhaps even faith is not something to be sniffed at. But in the end, she had too much of one and was too rigid in the other. This led to an inflexibility lacking in the other members of her family. Compare this with her father or her grandfather, who, when stopped down one path, would immediately choose another, never to be stopped. Above all, Mary was half Spanish and all Catholic, which led her to ally the country with the Spanish Empire, sometimes against its best interests, and attempt to undo the Reformation, whatever the human cost. Both policies would bring misery to her people and infamy to her reign. The first major issue facing Mary was that of her own marriage. Now, of course, for most of her sad, lonely life, Mary had been the least eligible bachelorette in England. She'd been disowned by her father and shunted aside by her brother. Now suddenly, miraculously in her view, at the age of 37, she was a catch. Now, in fact, contemporary attitudes to gender, which had almost cost her the throne, now dictated that she had to marry. This society was not comfortable with the idea of an independent, unattached woman. Mary felt a similar urgency, for she wanted an heir before time and her body gave out. The Privy Council and other prominent subjects urged her to marry an Englishman, but her choices were limited. The only name they really came up with was Edward Courtney, Earl of Devon, a descendant of Edward IV. This was apparently his only recommendation. According to the imperial ambassador, he was proud, poor, obstinate, inexperienced, and vindictive. Just what you're looking for in a husband. But Mary, wanting to solidify England's place in Catholic Europe, always more comfortable with the Spanish side of the family anyway, they hadn't repudiated her, opted instead for her cousin, the son of Charles V, the heir to the Spanish throne, Philip, King of Naples, the future Philip II of Spain. This choice was opposed not only by her Privy Council, but also by many of her subjects. As one rebellious Norwich carpenter put it, "If the marriage to a Spaniard take place, we should lie in swine sties, in caves, and the Spaniards should have our houses, and we should live like slaves." The English were never known for their sort of cosmopolitan openness. In January of 1554, Sir Thomas Wyatt raised a rebellion of 3,000 men in Kent, as well as that Norwich carpenter, and marched on London. Their goal was to prevent the Spanish marriage, and possibly displace Mary in favor of the Protestant Elizabeth. Lacking an army of her own, Mary appealed eloquently to her subjects' loyalty by going to the Guildhall and making a speech. The Guildhall, by the way, is the City Hall of London. "I am your queen, to whom at my coronation, when I was wedded to the realm and laws of the same, the spousal ring I have on my finger, which never hitherto was, nor hereafter shall be left off. You promised your allegiance and obedience to me, and I say to you on the word of a prince, I cannot tell how naturally the mother loveth the child, for I was never the mother of any. Even now it's an obsession. But certainly, if a prince and governor may as naturally and earnestly love her subjects as the mother doth love the child, then assure yourselves that I, being your lady and mistress, do as earnestly and tenderly love and favor you. And I, thus loving you, cannot but think that ye as heartily and faithfully love me. Then I doubt not, but we shall give these rebels a short and speedy overthrow." She spoke like a Tudor. That speech was worthy of Elizabeth, her sister. It's easy to forget sometimes that Mary was a Tudor too. She then rallied the royal guards and the remnants of Northumberland's army, But in fact, they proved useless in the end. The key was actually the staunch resistance of the city of London, whom she'd rallied in that Guildhall speech, which refused entrance and therefore stopped the rebels. Do you remember that moment in the Wars of the Roses when London closed its gates on the victorious Lancastrian army? London is always an important variable in that calculus of power in England. If you lose London, you lose England. If you keep London, you've got a chance. Numerous English politicians have realized that, and of course Adolf Hitler found that out to his cost in the 1940s. Afterwards, Wyatt and about 90 of his followers were executed, along with Lady Jane Grey and Guildford Dudley. It was just too dangerous to let them live. Princess Elizabeth also came under suspicion and was lodged in the Tower, but she'd been careful to avoid overt involvement in Wyatt's plot. She would have been happy to see it succeed, but she maintained her distance from the rebels. The marriage to Philip took place amid spectacular pomp at Winchester Cathedral in July of 1554. It would not prove happy. Mary loved Philip and wanted an heir. Within months, she experienced a false pregnancy. But Philip saw the alliance as purely diplomatic. But in the meantime, the Tudor queen, like her predecessors, had gotten her way. She would not be so lucky or successful in the area of religion. The return to Rome was the principal policy goal of Mary's reign. To achieve it, to undo what Henry VIII and Edward VI had done, Mary would, like them, have to turn to Parliament. Note what Henry started. Do you remember? Parliaments never used to discuss religion, but once he goes to Parliament for the Reformation, it is inevitable the Parliament will say, we have to have a role here. This was a problem. That is, turning to Parliament to return England to Rome, because the landowners whom Parliament represented had much to lose from a Catholic restoration, namely all those lovely monastic lands that they would have to give up. The problem was solved in the fall and winter of 1553-54. First, Parliament revoked the Acts of Uniformity. Then it banned the Book of Common Prayer. But they would go no further because of the monastic lands. Until, late in 1554, Reginald Cardinal Poole, Mary's principal advisor in religious affairs, returned from Rome with a dispensation from the Pope to allow purchasers to keep their monastic lands. Now, in the short term, this made possible the further restoration of Roman Catholicism in England. In January of 1555, Parliament consented to reestablish the Pope's power. It also reenacted the heresy laws, more anon. But in the long term, this dealt a terrible blow to the prospects for restoration, because it meant that the monasteries, the almshouses, the guilds, the schools, the hospitals would never be restored. Mary tried to found a few, but she had no money and no time. And so this would make it all the more difficult to win Mary's subjects back to the faith. In its absence, all Mary could do was mandate the return to Catholic forms of worship, restore the deprived Catholic bishops, bringing them back out of the Tower like Gardiner and Tunstall, and deprive priests who'd married or refused to recant Protestantism. She ejected about 2,000 priests. Now, in the short term, this is good for Catholicism and that these people were either married or preaching against Catholicism. But in the long term, this exacerbated the problems of absenteeism and pluralism. 2,000 priests is about a quarter of the priesthood, and those people are not going to be replaced very quickly. It must also have been terribly hard on the families of these men. Still, recent evidence suggests that most churches and their parishioners went back to the Latin Mass, restored their crosses and images, many of which had been buried, and they brought them back and dusted them off. And they did so sometimes eagerly, often without a murmur. But there was a significant minority who did not. For some, the new emphasis on full-blown Catholicism was strange or threatening. Others were committed Protestants. They had only two choices. They could flee. Some 800 fled to the continent. These Marian exiles flocked to centers of Protestantism like Frankfurt or Geneva to imbibe Protestant theology at its wellspring. So about 800 got out. Others stayed to face persecution by burning at the stake. It was the burnings which put the bloody in Bloody Mary. The burnings began in February 1555 with John Rogers, whose crime was to translate the Bible into English. They continued in Oxford with the burnings of Hugh Latimer, Bishop of Worcester, and Nicholas Ridley, Bishop of London. That was followed by the burning of Thomas Cranmer, the Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury and author of the Book of Common Prayer. It is said that as the flames were being lit, Latimer called out, "Be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out." But personally, I find Cranmer's story perhaps the most moving. Cranmer is a man who, all through his life, had changed. His spirituality had evolved. And he had doubts at various times in his life about the Protestant direction in which it had evolved. He was given numerous chances in prison to recant his Protestantism. Mary really wanted this, for he'd been the point man of the Edwardian Reformation, the author of the Book of Common Prayer. In fact, Cranmer, faced with death, did recant 6 times, admitting, "The Pope was right, I'm loyal to the Pope, I was wrong." It's easy to see this as a sign of weakness. Personally, I see it as a sign of humanity. But when, on the 21st of March, 1556, he was brought to St. Mary's Church in Oxford to recant publicly before his death, he did something unusual. He knelt, he wept and prayed, and then he stood and said the following, "And now I come to the great thing that troubleth my conscience more than any other thing that ever I said or did in my life, and that is the setting abroad of writings contrary to truth." Okay, so far the Catholics are happy in the audience. "Which here I renounce and refuse as things written with my hand contrary to the truth which I thought in my heart, and written for fear of death and to save my life." At this point they must have been worried. "If it might be, and that is, all such bills which I have written or signed with mine own hand since my degradation from being archbishop, wherein I have written many things untrue, and for as much as my hand offended in writing contrary to my heart, therefore my hand shall first be punished. For if I may come to the fire, it shall first be burned. And as for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and Antichrist with all his false doctrine." At that point, there was an uproar. It's said that Cranmer was brought to the stake with a cheerful countenance and a willing mind. He was probably the only person smiling in this crowd. When the fire was lit, he took his hand, saying, "This was the hand that wrote it, and therefore shall it suffer the first punishment." And then he thrust it into the flame. All the witnesses agree that he stood there holding his hand in the flame. And then he was brought closer, and the flames engulfed him. You didn't have to be a Protestant bishop to merit the attentions of Mary's regime. Over the next few years, she ordered the burning of 290 individuals, 237 men, 52 women, many of them adolescents, most of humble background. Most of the burnings took place at Smithfield Market in London. Others were driven from their homes or imprisoned. Why did Mary pursue a course which can only strike the modern observer as barbaric? The operative word here is, of course, modern. Like most contemporaries, she rejected the idea of religious toleration, or that two people could disagree about something so fundamental as how to worship God and still both be good people or good subjects. As the Protestant William Cecil put it, that state could never be in safety where there was toleration of two religions. Mary believed that hers was the one true faith, and that anyone who disagreed with it was a disloyal subject, a heretic, a minion of the devil, and so a double menace to society, dragging her subjects not only into disobedience, but ultimately to hell. By this argument, to allow two faiths in England was tantamount to acquiescing in her subjects' damnation, something which no good mother in the great chain of being could do. It was Mary's solemn duty to cut out the cancer before it spread. Now, in her defense, it should be pointed out that what she really wanted were recantations, not actual burnings. The hope was that with a few examples, people would change their minds. So in her mind, the Protestant martyrs brought their own fates upon themselves by their stubborn refusal to see the light. Now, you should also remember that these weren't the only Tudor martyrs to religion. Henry VII burnt Lollards at the stake. Henry VIII executed both Lutheran heretics and Catholic traitors. He was an equal opportunity persecutor. Elizabeth I would execute about 250 Catholics, just about the same number as Mary, albeit mostly priests and far more reluctantly. Elizabeth didn't want to do it, but she felt she was forced to by Parliament, as you will learn. So, given that long bloody history, why do we remember this Tudor as Bloody Mary? Why did the fires of Smithfield prove to be a public relations disaster for the Marian regime and for the cause of Catholicism in England? Why didn't Marian England become devoutly, uniformly Catholic? Mostly because Marian England didn't last long enough. Not because her subjects were already Protestants. In fact, there's plenty of evidence that it was working. The Protestant martyrs weren't recanting, but in fact, in the countryside, there's plenty of evidence of people going back to the old ways and not really all that much grumbling. 300 people is not that many people given the total population of England. It might have worked had her reign lasted or had she had an heir. As for the reputation of Bloody Mary, what happened here is, once her reign ended in 1558, Protestants began to write its history, in particular John Fox, who wrote the Acts and Monuments of the English People, better known as the Book of Martyrs. This work portrayed the burning of each martyr in the most grisly but also inspiring detail. Take Fox's description of the burning of Bishop Hooper in February 1555. Now, Bishop Hooper was not the most popular clergyman in England. As Bishop of Gloucester and Worcester, he'd been anything but popular with his flock, for he was a zealous busybody who constantly tested his clergy's knowledge of the Bible and inquired into the morals of the laity, the sort of clergyman who can sometimes annoy the people in his flock. But thanks to Fox, what people remembered about Hooper was how he died at the hands of Catholic persecutors. When he was black in the mouth, and his tongue swollen that he could not speak, yet his lips went till they were shrunk to the gums, and he did knock his breast with his hands until one of his arms fell off, and then knocked still with the other what time the fat, water, and blood dropped out at his fingers' ends, until by renewing of the fire his strength was gone, and his hand did cleave fast in knocking to the iron upon his breast. So immediately bowing forwards, he yielded up his spirit. With prose like that, Fox's Book of Martyrs became the best-selling work in English after the Bible. The Protestant martyrs sank deep into the consciousness of the English people. English school children were raised on these stories. Given the shortage of Catholic priests, the lack of a Catholic polemical tradition in response, and the long Protestant reign of Queen Elizabeth subsequently, the Catholic side of this story, including the stories of Catholic martyrdom and Protestant cruelty. Remember Thomas More? Remember Bishop Fisher? Remember Elizabeth's martyrs? These stories were simply not told. Over the course of the next century, as the English faced Catholic invasions from abroad and plots at home, Fox's stories of Mary's cruelty would convince his readers that God had chosen them as an elect Protestant nation facing the forces of the cruel Catholic Antichrist. With all that, Mary and the Catholics might still have gotten to write this history if she had lived longer or produced an heir. But neither was to happen. In January of 1557, Mary's husband, now Philip II of Spain, showed that he was interested in something other than an heir by declaring war on France. He expected Mary's England, which he regarded as community property, to join him in this war. The Privy Council and the Parliament opposed it. England was in the grip of an economic crisis and an influenza epidemic. It lacked an adequate army. But Mary overruled her counselors on two grounds. First, there was loyalty to her husband. Philip willed it. Mary always fulfills that gender role. She always does what the good girl is supposed to do. And her husband told her, "We're going to fight a war. We're going to fight a war." The second reason was there were lots of nobles who were interested in this war for the glory that it would bring. Interestingly, a lot of them were Protestant nobles who in January of 1557 are betting that Mary's going to be around a long time, and they want to prove that they're loyal. They want to undo the reputation they may have created under Edward VI or during Wyatt's rebellion. But the war went badly, partly because Parliament refused to pay for it. In January of 1558, the French surprised and captured the last English possession in France, Calais. Now, Calais had no real strategic significance to England anymore, but its psychological importance was immense. This was the last outpost of that continental empire which stretched back to William the Conqueror. It was associated with the great warrior kings like Edward III and Henry V, and now Mary, a woman and a Catholic, had lost it. For many of her subjects, this summed up all the lost opportunities of the reign. Mary herself remarked to her ladies-in-waiting that, "When I am dead and opened, you will find Calais lying in my heart." They would not have to wait very long. During the spring and summer of 1558, Mary once again thought herself pregnant. In fact, she was probably suffering from a uterine tumor and dropsy. Her reign is built upon irony. As late as early November 1558, she hoped for a miracle, that this was the pregnancy. And by the way, at this point, Philip hasn't even been in the country. It would be a virgin birth. It would be a miracle. Her Privy Council was more hard-headed. They persuaded her to finally recognize Elizabeth as her heir so as to avoid the confusion of 1553. Now, up to this point, Elizabeth had lived a shadowy and tenuous an existence, as Mary had done before her accession. Disowned, then reinstated by her father, she had got along better with the Protestant Edward than with the Catholic Mary, who always resented Elizabeth's mother. Remember that in Mary's eyes, Elizabeth's mother was the woman who had displaced her own mother. Mary also suspected Elizabeth of being a secret Protestant, which was true, and of disloyalty. Now, in fact, Elizabeth had been the focus of a number of Protestant plots against the Queen, but she was careful to avoid much contact with the plotters, some of whom had gone to the block, and by the way, without naming her. And she had been careful to avoid any overt act of disloyalty. As a consequence, the most that Mary felt able to do was keep Elizabeth under house arrest, sometimes in the tower, sometimes in the countryside. Usually there'd be an elaborate cat-and-mouse game. Mary would set Elizabeth about with spies, with jailers, but for the most part, these men were no match for the wit and the cunning of Princess Elizabeth, and she was able to basically talk her way out of any accusation. Now, with the smell of death wafting over from Whitehall Palace, Elizabeth began to hold court. On the 17th of November, she was informed that her sister had died. As Mary died, she apparently was delirious. And when she came out of the delirium in the early hours of the 17th of November, she told her attendants that she had dreamed of little children who had approached her and given her flowers. So even at the end, I mean, this strange reign is such a combination of the touching and the cruel. One never knows how to feel about Mary. She always gives historians a hard time. Later that morning, Mary died, and Elizabeth was informed that she was now queen. England was to be ruled by another female. It has been said that Mary's reign, like her person, was sterile. Possessing many Tudor virtues, she lacked the two most essential of all: an instinct for what her people wanted, and the flexibility to give it to them. Rather, she followed her Catholic conscience and her Spanish heart to disaster, forcing on her subjects a Spanish marriage they didn't want, a bloody counter-reformation, and a losing war. Admittedly, with more time, she might have bent the country to her will, as her father had done. But without that time, or an heir to continue her policies, they were subject to reversal, repudiation, and excoriation by her successor. Worse, Mary Tudor had confirmed everything that contemporaries feared about female rule. She left her sister a legacy of religious disunity, military defeat, financial exhaustion, economic hardship, even a fatal influenza epidemic that good Protestants blamed on the sinfulness of the regime. And of course, she left the baggage of her gender. Who could anticipate with optimism rule by another Tudor queen? Boy, were they in for a surprise.